accessible at 29529. Mr. Tom Austin, real 8. Now, well, so you landed, you said, and you said, what were you saying about the system of smudge products? What was it like to land with them?
Well, you got used to it. I mean, bear in mind, in the States, of course, weather conditions were far better. That's all we had out there. It was just a light that you could see of a wick burning on a little pot.
Now, so what happened when you landed?
Well, when you landed, you went back to dispersal and shut down.
Then you.
Oh no, I need to make sure the aircraft was secure, etc. But as I say,
would there be a formal handover to the ground crew? Would you tell them what was up?
Oh yes, you would tell them if there was any trouble that you experienced with engines or whatever. But going back to what I said earlier on, leaving the aircraft, you had to make sure that you went straight forward.
Explain that again, because it's in the right.
Well, the entrance to the Wellington was in the front through a hatch, and you climbed a ladder and went straight in. But of course, coming out, you were on a level with the propellers, and it was only if the engines were still running. Obviously, normally speaking, you'd shut down before you left the aircraft, at any rate. But this was when you were doing practice circuits and bumps and things like that, that sort of thing. No, you just came. You reported, as you say, to the ground staff if there were any defects, and then a transport would come along and pick you up and take you down for debriefing.
Now, what was debriefing?
Debriefing was you went in, and again, this varied squadron to squadron, I think. You were given a cup of coffee, etc., and when there was availability for the intelligence officer to brief you or debrief you, you went in and sat round the table.
So it's done crew by crew.
And she asked you various questions. And not always a she, sometimes it was a man, but there were quite often there were ladies doing it, WAF officers. And as a matter of fact, going back to the question of dropping the bomb on the Hague or these incendiaries.
We'll come to that, because that's a different thing, right? It's a different time.
Well, you reported any particular things. You reported if you'd... of course, the navigator would note in his log if we saw an aircraft going down, the time and position and all the rest of it. And, of course, also I forgot to mention the fact that as you dropped your bombs, you took a picture. Now, this was activated by the fact that you had a thing called a flash, which was stowed in the airplane, which went out, and there was this enormous brilliant light happened as timed as your bombs hit the ground. So that it was a success to get a good photograph, because... depending on the weather conditions, etc., cloud and what have you, they could gain a lot of information from seeing what you'd actually, where your bomb had gone down, or bombs.
Anything else about the debriefing?
No. We used to get coffee, and we used to get a rum ration on
now
our squadron.
A proper rum ration?
Yes.
So after, not before?
No, after.
Now, did you take the rum ration?
I did, yes. Well... It settled your nerves and warmed you up for a start. The MO used to dish this out, you see.
And what sort of, was it just a proper, a normal size rum ration, or was it quite...
No, a normal size rum ration.
But not too much?
Oh, not too much, no.
Was
no.
It watered down or neat?
Neat, as far as I know. It used to come out of a jar neat, anyway, as far as... And then, of course, once you'd finished your... then you took all your gear off, and then you, of course, you went to the mess for your food again, bacon and eggs.
Another crew meal.
Well, yeah, another crew meal. We used to have one chap, I always remember, in the sergeant's mess, where when he got back and we'd had the meal, he would immediately go to, we had a radiogram there, and he'd play a particular tune that he was fond of. Didn't make any difference, it was 4 o'clock in the morning. That was it. If it was unfortunate that one aircraft didn't come back or that, obviously you realise this. Sometimes, of course, you knew the crew pretty well. I don't think it dwelled on anybody. It was accepted as a condition that you had to bear up with on this. I mean, you made friends with people, and the significance came as when they didn't come back. It sought some time to know whether they were taken prisoners or not, you know. And you might be billeted with another crew, you see.
Well, let's talk a bit about the conditions. What were your billets like? I mean, were you in billets or in a hut?
No, in Nissen huts.
And what were the huts like? How much did you have, you know, as a sergeant?
Well, I think we had about 10 in a hut, something like that. The conditions, they were always in woods, generally speaking, and they always appeared to be damp. That was the one thing. The conditions, you had a stove, which was a coke-burning stove in the middle. Ablutions, washing facilities, etc., were also outside.
Now, what about the sergeant's mess? What was that like?
The sergeant's mess was a very friendly place, definitely. There was one.
Was it a hut as well? What was it like?
We were all, well, you had relaxing armchairs, etc. One of the members of the squadron would be a mess sergeant in charge of conditions in the mess. In other words, what food was given out, etc. Sometimes you had a chap who would make it his business that the food was far better in one mess than another, shall we say. But one of the difficulties with the air crew was the fact of if you had a mixed crew of commissioned and non-commissioned. Because obviously the officers went to the officers. At this particular time, at the beginning of our tour, of course, we were all sergeants. Can I go on to the fact of now one, the navigator? Because this comes to about the fourth trip.
I can see it does, yeah. Let's just deal with the sergeant's mess as well. So it was in a hut.
It's a big Nissen hut.
What about drinking habits in there? I know you weren't a drinker, but
no.
What were drinking habits like in there?
Well, it varied on the individuals, you know. There wasn't so much regulation, shall we say, as officers, because our mess bills weren't as large as the officers' bills, generally speaking. Shall we say...
Did you start drinking more?
No, I don't think so. Shall we say you got friendly with the right people, for argument's sake. For instance, if you weren't operating, we got to know the girls cooking in the mess, etc. And when we weren't actually operating and that, we often used to get food brought out to us. We might have a little sleep in or something, you know, if we hadn't got any duty on. This happened, and it was a very compact community. In other words, a family.
Before we come to the next, would you go out as a crew to the local pubs? I don't know whether England has.
Yes, and you'd probably take the ground crew at times with you. Let them.
What would a typical visit to a pub be like?
Well, I mean, bear in mind that certainly spirits were short. I mean, by this time, I would drink a whiskey if necessary, you know, but, I mean, you probably wouldn't get that, so I'd probably suffer with half a pint of beer, and that would do my lot. We were fortunate, shall we say, in the fact that we had two Australians in the crew, incidentally, because they used to get these wonderful fruitcakes sent over, which we all shared.
And you'd all go to the pub together.
As a group.
Sometimes you'd take your grand crew with you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, of course, when we got leave...
Hang on. Was it a friendly atmosphere in the pub?
Very much so.
Were you welcomed by the locals?
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Now, tell me about the problem with the navigator. Only four. It looks like the Wilmshaven raid.
That's right.
19th of February. It says abandoned and then dash nav.
US. Yeah. Well, what actually happened was this, that we were briefed to go to Wilmshaven, and which is a long trip over the North Sea. And I think we'd been flying for over 2 hours. We'd kept to the courses that the navigator gave us, you see, or gave me. And then, after about 2 hours, he called up on the intercom and said, "I can't carry on." So I said, "Well, what do you mean?" "I just can't carry on," he said. Well, I said to my bomb aimer, Jack, who used to stand or sit beside me, you see, as a precaution that if anything hit me, he'd be available. Anyway, I said to Jack, "Well, would you go back and see what the score is?" And when he went back, after a little while, he called up on the intercom and said, "You'll never believe it," he said, "but there's nothing on his charts at all." In other words, he hadn't even worked any navigational problems out from the word go. So we thought, well, we got to abandon. I said to him, "You realise that we got to abandon the trip, and the only reason I can give is you've packed in." And he was only too happy about this, you know, just get me down sort of thing. Well, we hadn't got a clue where we were, and we worked back on the time we'd been on certain courses, and eventually worked backwards. We had a fair idea of weather conditions, wind, etc., from what we've been told at the briefing. And we were very fortunate to hit the beacon at Manby on the east coast. So we came back, we landed, and we were debriefed, and I gave the reason that the navigator had packed in. Now, the following morning, he'd had a good night's rest, and he changed his tune and said that he wasn't well. Well, I spoke to him and I said, "Look, personally, I've got nothing against you, Bill, but the fact is, you know what happened, and you know as well as I do that it was your nerves that gave, nothing else." Well, he was posted. To this day, I don't know what happened. But you see, the trouble when the person went, what we called like a modified LMF, we were the only service that operated this system.
What was the system? Just explain.
Well, the system was, you see, that they thought, the higher authorities in the Air Ministry, etc., thought that if you gave way to so many people saying, I've seen what it's like, I've had enough, you could almost finish up with a deluge of people doing this. Mind you, in the Navy, I understand, if you were, again, in a submarine, it was purely voluntary, and I believe you could opt out there without any disgrace whatsoever. Now, when you were, the awkward thing about the whole lot was that if you were non-commissioned, you were stripped right down to the lowest rank, AC2. Strangely enough, they never did take your badge from you, but obviously you would never wear it again because it would be so obvious of what had gone wrong. If you were commissioned, incidentally, as far as I know, the people didn't lose their commission. And if they got transferred to a place on other duties, if nobody actually knew them, their history, that was it. So, as I say, Bill Bartlett, he was posted. I I've tried to find out, but I've got no means now of ever really discovering. I don't think he ever got put back on ops. Once he was stripped down, that was it. He'd get menial duties. And
now, who was your replacement?
Well, now, this started something, because if you were a crew and one of the members, for one reason or another, got taken out, as he did, you then had to be given replacements of people who weren't in a crew already. They were spare, what we call a spare bod. Well, fortunately, the man I was given, Eric Overbury, was older than Overbury.
Eric.
He was a marvellous navigator. He really was. Very calm and collected. He never seemed to get highly strung up about anything. If I asked him how things were going, you'd get a very welcome reply that everything's okay, you know? And, of course, I got very friendly with Eric, particularly he came from Lewes in Sussex. And, as I say, he was a very good navigator. But then, of course, when he'd already had more operations under his belt than we did. So I had various navigators. Eric was the one that finished with me, but I had, for instance, a navigator who was in the Canadian Air Force, and his name was Carlson. And this came later, as a matter of fact, Carlson. But I had various navigators who could fit in.
Okay, well, leaving it over briefly, we'll come back to Carlson a bit later. Now, did this new chap gel in with the rest of you?
Oh, yes.
Because you'd only done, well, four.
Yeah,
five.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, we don't go through raid by raid, but in a sense, it's almost what you recall. You start making various bombing raids on various places.
Yeah.
You know. And obviously, you stop bombing ports and start bombing Germany.
Yeah.
There's a raid in Cologne on February the 26th.
Yeah.
And you have terrible trouble there. Bombs dropped in Holland. Now, that's the raid where you dropped them on the Hague.
That is right.
Now, that was on February the 26th. Now, tell me a bit more about that in detail, because now we actually know.
Well, we lost a...
And the aftermath.
We lost an engine. And I considered that we hadn't got far enough to continue just on one engine. I mean, it's better to get the aircraft back and fight another day than to press on at, well, almost hopeless odds. So I determined to abandon the trip, and I said, well, one way, we had all mainly incendiaries on. I'm not going to waste these and just put them in the sea or something. And as I say, when I got back, they said, where did you drop your bomb? So I said, The Hague. And, of course, there was a matter of concern. As a matter of fact, it was a French WAF officer. And she said, do you know it's an open city? I said, well, nobody ever told me it was an open city. And she said, well, perhaps if you were fired on, she said, and you had to jettison your bombs, that would be a legitimate excuse. I said, well, more or less, if you want to put that down, you can. I've been quite honest with you. And that's what it actually put down to save any recriminations on this, as the fact that we had fired. As a matter of fact, in The Hague, there was nothing. You could see Amsterdam and Rotterdam putting large lots of flak up, but The Hague itself just had nothing.
Did you ever hear any more about it?
No, heard nothing at all. And as I say, I never was given the photograph, because if you got an aiming point photograph on a bombing raid, you were presented with the photograph, you see. I saw the photograph, and you could literally plot it. But there again.
Now, the next big raid seems to be on Cologne, Hamburg, sorry.
Hamburg. Well, that was the time on Hamburg when we started dropping window.
Now, tell me about that.
Well, some days before, we were all called into duty, and we were given these packages, window, which was black on one side and metallic on the other, and we had to get these ready. Now, the idea of window, you took these packets, brown paper packets with a string around, and you took them into the aircraft, you see, they went in the aircraft, and you dropped these through the flare chute. Well, and the unfortunate thing with this is the fact that you got the chaps who did that, like the bomb aimer, etc., you got as black as a sweep, because sometimes if you didn't drop them correctly through the chute, they would come back on you in the aircraft, you see. But it definitely worked. That first time they dropped the window in Hamburg, it upset all the radar-controlled searchlights and everything. There were no two ways about that. And the principle, of course, even to these days, it's called chaff nowadays, I believe. It still exists. It's a deterrent to put their instruments out of focus and all the rest of it on the thing.
You seem to be flying with the levers there. Is he Sergeant Levers?
Levers, yeah. Levers. Yeah, that's right.
And then I noticed Overbury.
Yeah, that'll be there. That's right.
Now, there's other operations over Duisburg, Saint-Nazaire. I don't know whether you remember anything about them. Again, you have to Duisburg, Germany.
Oh, that's the Ruhr.
Was the Ruhr a particularly bad target?
It was. It's like the Midlands in England, shall we say. Terrific concentration of industry, heavy industry, steelworks. I mean, Krupps was the big place, Essen, for instance. And it was very highly defended, obviously, because it was their main industrial area. And you got one town after the other. So that if you didn't do the correct thing of getting out of the way coming back, if you strayed over there, there was so much concentration of firepower there that, it wasn't a happy place. We call it Happy Valley.
that was Duisburg.
Yeah.
And then the next one on Saint-Nazaire, you have more trouble. Aircraft unstable.
Yes.
Bombs, jets, and Do you remember, I realise you can't remember the raid, but I mean, that seems quite unusual. What was up with the aircraft? Or do you not remember?
That was still on Wellingtons, aren't we?
That's a Wellington,
yeah.
3, over Saint-Nazaire, and it's 28th of March.
Yeah, I can't remember what the stability question was there, but it was unstable.
And it happens again over Kiel, a bit later, you know, as you move on.
Yeah.
That's a Mark 10. Any other raids you particularly, if you want to have a look, any other raids in that period you particularly remember?
Operations La Rochelle, gardening. Now, gardening was dropping mines.
Oh, well, tell me about that, because we haven't done that.
No. What happened was that the mines, I mean, the popular conception of a mine was this round object with the little things on it, you know, which you had a parachute on them, and they were cylindrical things, which you normally dropped round about 700 feet. Now, the idea was, down this particular raid on La Rochelle, there was an island out there called the Ile de Ré, which is very similar to, shall we say, the Isle of Wight, not so big. We were briefed to go in. We'd fly over France to start with, across the Bay of Biscay area, come out, and then the idea of dropping, the mines were acoustic, and magnetic. And the idea was to drop them from where L'Oréal, Saint Nazaire, etc., these U-boat bases, the U-boats would come out and take a course up the coast. And the idea was that you lay them on their route so that there was every chance of them activating the mines. So this particular place, the Ile de Ré, I remember going through there because there were cliffs of about, a few hundred feet. And they, of course, they knew, they heard you coming along, and they would shine searchlights down either side from La Rochelle and the Ile de Ré onto the sea. And then as you went through to drop your mines, they'd throw everything they had at you. Which is sort of running the gauntlet.
At low level.
At low level. So, as I say, I think they lost quite a lot of U-boats this way, the very fact that they won the main exits from... the trouble was, you see, if you flew low level at night, you didn't have much opportunity of any evasive action if you did get caught. I mean, I've known it to go over an enemy fighter base that we knew of. As a matter of fact, one base had a wonderful name, Curling Bastard, it was called. And some of these fighter chaps were dead keen, would follow you right down towards, you know, what, if you was low flying. It didn't mean to say you'd get away with it. It depended on the individual themselves, obviously, but... mining was not always an easy proposition. It could be very dodgy indeed. And of course, one thing I haven't mentioned before is the fact that off the enemy coast, there were such things as flak ships. Now, the flak ships were heavily armoured as far as anti-aircraft guns were concerned, but they were never on a particular position. They'd move them. So you would never know until the thing opened up at you the danger of it. I mean, you were flying along quite nicely, and then suddenly all hell would be let loose because of these flak ships.